From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Bob Carlson, and this is Unfictional. Unfictional is KCRW's program of stories and original documentaries. It's a part of KCRW's Independent Producer Project, a laboratory for independent radio producers, writers, and performers. And because the Olympics are still in full swing, I've got a couple of stories that are not about the Olympics exactly, but more like the shadow the Olympics cast over us. We've all grown up watching it on TV every few years, and it's so easy to get pulled into the drama of watching people have this true peak moment in their lives, especially when the person you're watching isn't one of those robo-athletes with bodies that have been perfectly tuned for a 200-meter butterfly. Instead, I really like the archers that have a little bit of a gut, or a judoka, who's suddenly realizing that millions of people are interested in what they're doing for a change. And then, after the Olympics are gone, it always makes me wonder about what happens to these people after they've had their moment. It's this one brief, intense experience, and then it's gone, and then what?
You spend years and years and years of your life, and you make a lot of sacrifices to focus on the achievement of a goal, and then all of a sudden it's over, and there is no detraining program or decompression program to sort of introduce you to the real world again.
Matt Holtzman from KCRW recently went to this party that was to honor past Olympians. It was a room full of people who had their Olympic dream, and now it's a memory. And this one guy he talked to is named Andrew Strenk. He actually won a gold medal competing in the 4x200 freestyle relay in Mexico City.
This is the parade uniform from 1968.
And it still fits pretty good.
It still fits. It's a little tighter than it was then. But I can still wear the belt and the pants, so it's not too bad.
I'm just surprised that it lasted this long.
Well, it doesn't get a lot of use, except for events like this, so maybe once a year.
After the Olympics, he continued his college education. He worked with the Olympic Committee in the 80s. Now he works in real estate. But come on, a gold medal. Even if you got one years ago, for the rest of your life, you've got an instant conversation topic at any bar or party you may ever go to, right?
In your new life after the Olympics, did you tell people that you were an Olympian, that you'd won a gold medal?
No, because my goal had actually been to win an individual event. That was a 1500 meter freestyle, and that didn't happen. And so when you're introduced around, you'll be in conversations, and people will want to know, well, what, how'd you do? And people say, well, you just won one. And if you didn't win multiple gold medals, then they're not interested. And so
has that happened to you?
Ostracized. Oh, it's happened to me many, many times.
Is that really what we've come to? We're so used to Americans bringing home gold medals by the fistful that one medal isn't enough for us anymore? Us, meaning those of us sitting on the couch, barely moving? And Andrew Strenk isn't the only one with stories like this. Some people are disappointed if instead of running or jumping, your gold medal was for something like sailing.
And other people didn't win a gold, they only won a silver. Or they won a bronze, or they were fourth, or they were sixth or seventh or eighth in the race. What happens is many members of the team come away feeling like they didn't really succeed, and it takes a while for you to readjust and realize that your glass of water is not half empty, that it actually is half full. But that takes a while to adjust to that perspective.
And on this episode of Unfictional, not the Olympics. Stories about the shadow that the Olympics cast over us. Beginning with this story from Anna Sachs. She was never an Olympian. Never came close. But there was this time in high school when she did get a chance to test herself at a high level of competition. You ever hear athletes talk about the moment when they know they've pushed past their limits on the way to greatness? Well, Anna's wasn't like that. Hers was a different kind of moment.
When I was growing up, before I hit puberty, I was kind of a scrawny little girl with scraggly hair and oversized glasses that were very high prescription strength, so they made my eyes look really tiny. I wore oversized clothes. I had a really huge head of curly hair. I was notoriously the last person picked for softball. The summer before seventh grade, I moved to Williamstown from Stockbridge, Massachusetts, which is about half an hour south. When we moved, I also got contact lenses, and that really was the turning point for me. That summer, I went to the town's field day where they had a bunch of outdoor races and competitions, and one of them was the 50-meter dash. And it was a mixed age group, so there were some kids there that were older than me. And I ended up winning the race. And it was exciting. Nobody knew who I was. I was this new girl. And that was really when I realized, hey, I really like to sprint. It feels really good. And I actually am not terrible at it. So that fall, I went out for cross country. And that's when I started running. In cross country, I was okay, but I really just really wanted to run fast. And so I wasn't so good at pacing myself. I used to walk on the parts of the course that were in the woods. And then the sections that were out in the open where all the people were cheering for you, I'd come out of the woods all rested and just run by really, really fast. Like, then as soon as I got back to the edge of the woods, I'd just start walking again. I started track in the spring of eighth grade. Both cross country and track were very popular at Mount Greylock. We had about 700 kids in the entire school, 7th through 12th, and over 100 kids on the track team. So we figured just about one out of every seven kids was on the track team. I knew I wanted to try hurdling from the beginning for two reasons. One, because my aunt, who I really adored, was a hurdler in high school, so I thought it would be really cool if I could do that also. The track at Mount Greylock was just an old dirt track with really, really old hurdles that they probably don't even make anymore, and they collapsed in a strange way. It was interesting that we were the best in the county, and we were the only team that didn't have a proper track surface. We had a large coaching staff. They were really great, dedicated people. They spent a lot of time coming up with workouts, teach us lessons about setting personal goals and being in shape. I think I was a natural. I love to run, I love to sprint, I love to jump over things. So I really don't remember struggling with it at all. I also don't remember really being afraid of doing it. When I was in eighth grade, I didn't know how to three-step, and three-stepping is really the key to success in hurdling. It allows you to go over the hurdle each time with the same lead leg, and most people have a dominant lead leg. So the difference is the people who are three-stepping, they look like they're actually sprinting, and the people taking four steps just look like they're sort of jogging or bouncing in between the hurdle. So one of my coaches, Larry Bell, the science teacher, he worked with me at Williams College on the weekends and the off season also. So ultimately, the way I was able to move to the next level in hurdling was by using the Williams College track and putting the hurdles slightly closer together than the regulation so that I knew I could make it over them if I took only three steps, and just practicing and practicing and trying to run as fast as I could. And then once I got more comfortable, I would move the hurdles back to their regular distance apart. When I finally accomplished the goal of being able to three-step in the 100-meter hurdles, everything changed for me instantly. It just felt more like the way that your body's supposed to move when you're sprinting. It's a more of a fluid kind of running, and you don't have to really think about the motion. You just go as fast as you can. And it felt more like that to be able to three-step. I was very competitive. I came in second a lot to another girl on my team. And she used to say, imagine how much faster you'd be if you three-step. The first race that I ran against her when I was three-stepping, I won by a lot. And she never beat me again after that. The fastest time I ever ran was at a track meet at the end of my junior year, 1995. It was a meet called the Individuals. It was kind of like the meet to decide who was the best in the county in each event. It was a beautiful, warm, sunny day. It was like the perfect day for a track meet. I had a perfect lane assignment. I was in the best shape of my life. And I knew when I crossed the finish line that I won. The 14.9 that I ran that day was a new school record for Mount Greylock, which I believe still stands. The other important thing about that time that I ran that day was that 14.9 qualified me to compete at the national championship for track and field. It was held at North Carolina State University. My family really couldn't afford to send me on that trip, so I had to raise the money on my own. When we arrived in North Carolina, one of the things my coaches discussed with me was the fact that many of the elite female sprinters in high school track were wearing spandex shirts and something that looked like a bikini bottom, like spandex underwear. So I purchased these very tight spandex bathing suit bottom type of a thing. The day of the track meet, I had a tan line from my regular shorts from about the middle of my thigh to my hip was a much whiter skin than the bottom of my legs, which was very noticeable. I was the only one from Western Mass to compete in the 100-meter hurdles, and I was unseated, which meant that my time was one of the slower times ran that season. I was very close to the cutoff time. I knew that I was really just a lane filler. But for me, it was really the pinnacle of my track career up to that point. I was getting to run with the best female athletes in the 100-meter hurdles in high school in the country. Regardless of what anyone else here does, I have an opportunity to run the fastest time of my life. I was focused on trying to beat the 14.9. So I noticed when I was lining up for my heat that I was in a lane next to a girl from a school in Philadelphia who was third in the country. I remember thinking that she was a lot shorter than me. So we got down in the starting blocks, and when the gun went off, I pushed so hard out of those blocks. And I knew immediately that I was running faster than I had ever run in my life. I could feel my track spikes digging into the ground. I could feel the wind on my face. I knew that I had had a really good start. I could also tell that this girl that was third in the country was right next to me, not ahead of me. Over the first hurdle, she was still next to me. Over the second hurdle, she was just slightly in front of me, but I was still running so fast. I was even in my own head saying, "Oh my God, I can't believe how fast I'm running." By the time I got to the third hurdle, she was in front of me. Then all of a sudden, she was on the ground. She had hit the third hurdle, apparently, and she rolled into my lane. And then all of a sudden, I realized I had to stop running because she was right there. There was nowhere for me to go. I mean, you're just tripping. Your body's moving so fast, and all of a sudden, you're trying to slow down, and you're just stumbling. And I stumbled for a couple steps. I remember my hands hitting the ground, and by that point, everybody in the race was gone. They had kept going. They were almost done with the race. Instantly, I just thought, push back up. I pushed back up as fast as I could, and I just kept running, and I just was thinking to myself, just, you've got to finish the race. Just keep going. When I crossed the finish line, I seemed to still hear all the cheering, which was probably for the people who had, you know, just finished a really good race. But I remember thinking it was almost like they were cheering for me because I got up and finished the race. Immediately after the race, my coaches met up with me. It was hard going up to them. I felt like I let them down because they had come so far and they had supported me so much and helped me train. And I felt really bad that I let them down. I really wanted to have my best time that day, and I knew they really wanted to be a part of that. And I knew that they really felt like I had it in me, like I could have done it. But instantly, my coach Donna really went into a frenzy of, we need to try to protest this. But in the span of time that it took my coach to formally make a protest, all of the other heats had gone. So that was it. The race had come and gone. And that was my fate. That was what it was going to be. I can't remember what my time was that day. I mean, it was a horrible, slow time, but I did what I went there to do. I finished the race. I ran the race that I, at that point in my life, I loved more than anything else. The girl who fell, she didn't even get up to finish the race, because to her, I think it wasn't worth competing if she wasn't gonna have a shot at winning. But for me, there was no way that I could have fathomed not getting up and finishing. I just felt like, you always get up, you always finish. I went on training and competing in college, and I ran in the low 15s, 15.2, 15.3 consistently, but I never ran 14.9 again. Years from then, I wasn't going to remember exactly what time I ran in every single race and exactly how many times I won and how many trophies I had. The thing that would stay with me was the feeling that I got from doing it, how it made me feel and how much I loved it, how much I loved running, sprinting and hurdling, just how great it felt.
That's Anna Sachs with a story recorded and edited by her husband, radio producer Rob Sachs, with additional production by me, Bob Carlson. You can find pictures of Anna from her hurdling days, along with some other photos and information, all at our website, kcrw.com/unfictional. And while you're there, you can leave a comment or become a fan of Unfictional on Facebook. Listening to Unfictional on KCRW.com. I'm Bob Carlson, and this episode is not about the Olympic Games, more like how the idea of the Olympics is such a part of our collective consciousness. So much so that you don't even blink if you hear about something called the Olympics of Eating or the Robot Olympics. Far less ridiculous, of course, are the Paralympics or the Special Olympics or something called the Summer National Senior Games. Thousands of seniors participate every other year in the senior games, in everything from tennis to basketball to track and field, competing at ages when a lot of folks have bad knees, bad hearts, or can't even get out of bed. So coming up right now is an excerpt from a film documentary called Age of Champions that profiles a number of these inspiring athletes, including a couple of brothers who are in their 90s.
Yes, I'm Bradford Tatum. Everybody calls me Brad. And that's my brother John, my big brother. I traveled with him all over. And we started swimming in the 20s, and we've been swimming ever since. We lived in a neighborhood where there wasn't a pool for blacks. Now, there were pools, but we couldn't go to them. So we had swam in the reflecting pool at the Lincoln Memorial, or in the river, or in the canal in Georgetown.
Take your mark. Hunt!
We've been competitive, you know, all our lives, playing baseball, football, basketball, tennis. And so this is another kind of competition.
I have never won a gold nationally like Brad has. Brad won 3 golds. But I used to beat him when he was young, but I can't beat him now.
The idea is to compete, and you don't have to win. But whenever you do win, it's a nice feeling, to feel in your age group that you're pretty good.
Winning is everything, Brad. What do you mean? Good guys finish last. Competing is all it is to it.
You're like 2 peas in a pod. He rolls this way, I roll that way too. So that's the way it goes.
I sure do. All right, man. Thank you. All right.
When I first met Bradford, I was a freshman, and he was the president of the senior class. Bradford was always a swimmer, and I thought he had a real pretty stroke, you know, when he swam. He's a very kind person and a very loving person, and people like Bradford. Now, I don't know what else I can say.
I'm handsome.
Oh, yeah, I forgot that. I forgot that. Yeah, he's saying, I don't know about that, Bradford. But he's tall. Well, he was tall when I married him. He's not so tall now.
In May, they called me in for a checkup.
Hello, Mr. Tatum. How are you doing today?
Fine.
How's the swimming going?
Pretty good.
Good?
Good.
You still having a good amount of energy?
Yeah. And they told me I had colon rectal cancer, is what I had.
How is your Metaport working for you?
Pretty good. It doesn't interfere with the swimming, and they can use it for the chemotherapy.
Let me take a look at that real quick.
They said that if I didn't have this operation, they wouldn't give me much hope for lasting out the whole year.
Deep breath in. Pull it out.
So I said, of course. As long as it's done after I come back from the Olympics. I didn't want it to be done ahead of the Olympics. I wanted it to be done after the Olympics. Then if anything happens and I didn't get back, that's all right.
Come on this way to the infusion center.
All right.
Your mark. Said I've never won a gold, and I'm gonna win a gold. I had silver, but I'm gonna win a gold medal.
Having lived through segregation, and now to have our first black president, it's a wonderful feeling, and one that I had doubts that we would ever see in our lifetime.
Mission accomplished.
Yes, I did. Yeah.
I knew you were going to win.
I won my first gold medal in national competition. Felt like I was on top of the world. I said, got a gold medal. Instead of on the side for third place or this side for second place, I was in the middle for the gold.
I think it's a lot of fun, win or lose. It's a lot of fun. And it keeps you interested, it keeps you going.
the 2011 Senior Olympics in Houston, Texas, John Tatum won another gold medal in the men's 90-94 age bracket of the 50-yard freestyle, and the two brothers medaled a total of 7 times in swimming. Bradford had surgery for his cancer, has fully recovered, and is now cancer-free. To find out more about these amazing athletes and how you can host a screening of the Age of Champions documentary, go to ageofchampions.org. We'll also have a link to that on our website, kcrw.com/unfictional.
To do in stormy weather, long may you run, long may you run, long may you run, although these changes have gone, with your chrome heart shining in the sun. Long may you run. Well, it was back in Blind River in 1962 when I last saw you alive. But we missed that ship on the long. Long may you run. Long may you run. Long may you run. Although these changes have come, with your chrome heart shining in the sun.
I'm Bob Carlson, producer of Unfictional, part of KCRW's independent producer project. The editor is Jacob Conrad. The music supervisor is Dan Wilcox. Production assistance from Monica Scott. Thanks to the Annenberg Foundation, the Goldhirsch Foundation, and the Roth Family Foundation for their support of the independent producer project and Unfictional. You can find past episodes at our website, kcrw.com/unfictional, or join us on Facebook. You can podcast the show or listen on demand with the KCRW mobile app. And if you do like the program, please tell your friends about it. Or even better, leave a review on iTunes. I'm Bob Carlson, and however you choose to listen, I hope you'll join me next time for Unfictional on KCRW and kcrw.com.